Welcome to Healthcare Unfiltered. I am your host, Chadi Nabhan, a hematologist and a medical oncologist, and I have interest in everything pertaining to healthcare, whether it is clinical advances, cancer research, all leadership issues, mentorship issues, and healthcare policy issues. Today's podcast reflects on the recent meeting that took place in the city of San Francisco. It was the 20th year anniversary of the ASCO GU meeting, where much of research was presented in kidney, bladder, and prostate cancers. And as you know, by following this podcast and subscribing to it right here on Healthcare Unfiltered, you get a lot of updates into what's going on. And if you are not there in the city of San Francisco, you are going to feel as if you were there. And the one who's going to bring it to life on this podcast is Dr. Pedro Barata, who is the director of the Clinical Genitourinary Medical Oncology Research Program at UH Seidman Cancer Center and Case Western University in Cleveland. Pedro actually also discussed some of the data that was presented in the kidney session. And we are going to talk about his presentation as well. Folks, this is a podcast you should not miss. I appreciate that you are tuning in because it means you are not missing it. Don't forget to subscribe to the show, rate it, and let your friends and colleagues know about this show and other shows on Healthcare Unfiltered, where we discuss recent updates from various meetings and congresses. Also, don't forget to, read my book, Toxic Exposure, The True Story Behind the Monsanto Trials and the Search for Justice. And here you go, the one and only Dr. Pedro Barata on Healthcare Unfiltered. He's here. He's in the studio of Healthcare Unfiltered. Pedro, you can be completely unfiltered, by the way, on this podcast.
That's amazing. Listen, you know, I've been dreaming about being here with you, and finally, dreams come true. That is true.
And it's so possible. It's possible. I can send you a T-shirt if I get your address.
So I have your book already. So now I need a T-shirt.
Oh, perfect. I have the book. Yep. See, by the way, folks, if you are listening to this, I did not ask Pedro to plug my book, but I appreciate the free plug.
Absolutely.
So a lot of people know about you in the GU world, but some folks not in the GU world do listen to this podcast, believe it or not. So let's do a quick intro as to who is the Pedro Barata.
Again, I'm not sure about the D, but sure. But Pedro, so I'm a father of two kids, Portuguese dude, likes Ronaldo, although, you know, probably not, but also likes Messi.
Yes.
So trained, born and raised in Lisbon, Portugal. And, my adventure in U.S. started, almost a decade ago. And so I live in Cleveland and, I'm a GU oncologist. So I treat patients with prostate, kidney, and bladder cancer. And my journey here started because I wanted to do trials and research and, offer new treatments to people. So I have been pursuing that as part of my career, and that shaped a lot of my, life path, I guess, and what shaped a lot of my decisions and helped, and I end up where I am right now. And we're very happy with this, quote unquote, new life, which was very unexpected, at least for me as a European with European culture and everything.
Well, we're very happy that you are here. Patients and researchers are benefiting from you. My friend, we both were together at the San Francisco ASCO GU meeting. It's the 20th year anniversary. I'm going to tell you something. I was at the first ASCO GU meeting.
Wow.
20 years ago.
You and what, 10 more people?
There were probably about like 300, 400 yeah. people. It was so small, but it's just fascinating to see the growth of it and the level of research.
I can tell you this year, Chetty, I think the registrations on the day off were around 3,200, 3,300, right? So it grew 10 times more, right? Tenfold, yeah.
Unbelievable. So let's start with kidney cancer, because sure. I want to start with this because you were a discussant of a couple of major abstracts, including right. a keynote 564, and you discussed that. So I want to start there. So, first of all, tell us the two abstracts you discussed, one after the other, and then I want to ask you questions about both of them and whether you saw any, shortcomings or things of that nature. So let's start with Keynote.
So I discussed two studies, right? One is 901 from Dr. Moser. It's basically two parts. He presented this time part B. So it's a complic it's not a complicated, but it basically the CheckMate 901 investigated a shorter duration of nivo or nivo EP. So part A had mainly EP nivo versus placebo. Part B had nivo and had also an EP nivo in there. So it's a 2-1-1 randomization. But we've seen data for the nivo on this part two and also the EP nivo, the shorter 200 patients or so. Negative study. There's no benefit seen there. Although there's some suggestion that some of the subgroups might be enriched for activity. And I'm talking about at least in his trial, we see some potentially additive benefit in the post-metastasectomy, in the PD-L1 positive, groups at least, and the sarcomatoid, right? But that was the study by Dr. Moser. And then Dr. Shoueri's data, right? Keynote 564, which we already knew was positive for disease-free survival, led to the approval by the FDA. And we can talk a little bit about that, right? What is considered clinically relevant in terms of disease-free survival in the absence of OS, because that's exactly what happened. And we have other examples of that. So the concept of adjuvant therapy, I'm sure you're going to be asking me about that. But then we also knew, with the press release, right, about the overall survival, everybody wanted to see the details of that data. So Dr. Shoueri ended up presenting that, which is the third interim analysis for that trial, by the way. And we've seen a survival advantage. And that was the data that Tony presented. And it's a clear positive trial. And by the way, we also see that, the post-metastasectomy, the sarcomatoid PD-L1 positives, they seem to be enriched for activity. And it's not perfect, small groups, subgroup analysis and so forth. So take it as with a grain of salt. But the reason I'm pointing that out is because, as we were sharing earlier, Shadi, not everybody will need treatment, right? And that's probably one of the shortcomings is, can we figure out who are the 50% of folks that are high risk with high risk features who will never recur, right? So it starts there. And then what do we do for patients who unfortunately, despite immunotherapy, will recur? I think those are perhaps the most hot topics. I try to address that during my discussion more on the selection part, because as you can imagine, they give you 12 minutes to go over two phase III trials. It's not a lot of time. And you are kind of limited in your what do you want to, and you have to be clear with your points. I think, for you for a discussion to make sense, you want to have to capture different perspectives. So I thought it would be relevant to capture not just the data and actually give my thoughts on the data, but also the community perspective. So I put up a couple of questions and polls on Twitter over time to understand that. I also present a little bit of data on the patient's perspective of the adjuvant therapy. I also present data from advocacy group. So I try quality of life and toxicity.
Yeah, no,
I
these
try to
are
cover
all, yeah,
those bases,
absolutely. Pedro, in the Keynote 564, basically patients were randomized either to pembrolizumab or to placebo for a full year of therapy. And pembrolizumab improved overall survival. Did the patients who were on placebo at the time of progression, did they receive pembrolizumab as well?
Yeah, great question. So the answer is yes, but not everybody. So if you do the math, right? So by the way, we're talking at 2 years, just to give context. We're basically talking about 68% disease-free survival at 2 years for the control group on Keynote on the pembro trial. We're talking roughly about 73 or so percent at 2 years for the CheckMate 901. So it appears that the group it was enrolled into the in the 564, might be at a higher risk for recurrence than the other trials. So that's one comment. And that shows if you look at the curves, you see that about 50% never recur. You see that the separation of the curves is about 8% or so, which might you might take that as long remissions or cures with immunotherapy. And then you see that about 40% of patients recur despite receiving pembrolizumab at different time points. But if you look at the two-year time point, you really talk about, less than 30% of patients who recur, right? You talk about, about 20+%, 25 or so, something down those numbers. Don't quote me on that because I don't have the curves in front of me. So the question is, what happened upon progression? And the reason I bring that up, Shadi, is because you don't have that many events, right? We're talking about in the 50s versus the 80s for events, for deaths. It's not a lot, right? So that's one comment. And so when you do the math about patients who recur, then you need to look at not everybody got subsequent therapy. So you look at patients who got subsequent therapy and then how many got immunotherapy. So the way we've seen the data was of patients who received subsequent therapy, 70% received checkpoints. And that's what I highlighted. However, to be transparent and fair, you could ask the question, okay, Pedro, but how many of those who recur, end up getting immunotherapy, and that number dropped for close to 50%. It's like 48 or so percent. So there's always the question, I think, about is that good? Is that bad? What exactly that means, right? Because as you know, Shadi, and I don't think we're ever going to get an answer, because when you run these studies across the world, as you know, patients around the world have access to different therapies. Some don't have access to therapies beyond clinical trials. And we know that, and that's the reality, the question is, how do you do it if you don't do it that way? So those are the numbers. I think I'm quoting those numbers correctly about patients who got checkpoints. But by the way, there was your question was a question during the Q&A, and I can tell you, Dr. Hammers asked a question, which is a very appropriate question, and the answer that Tony gave. It's also something I try to highlight a little bit on that particular table of what happened to patients who recur, which is in the local therapy. A quarter got radiation upon progression. A quarter got surgery. Some got both. We don't know how many. And we also don't know how many got that with systemic therapy versus alone, which raises the question. I thought when I saw that, I thought it was a bit too high. But the point, Shadi, is the following. You have patients, like I have a patient 2 weeks in 2 weeks ago I saw in clinic, had a tumor who, is oligometastatic recurrent or oligometastatic disease. He basically had a tumor in the muscle close to the shoulder who grew. That is a patient who just came off Pembro. I removed that and he's on observation. So what I'm trying to say is if this, not all the recurrences will require systemic therapy right away. By the way, we have never shown up to the KEYNOTE-564, we've never shown a benefit of adjuvant treatment for the post-metastasectomy group. So let's say if you remove a met and you are NED, no evidence of disease, you don't exactly know what is the benefit of systemic therapy. Some will believe that it is. Some will believe that it depends. Some will believe that not sure there's a benefit there, right? Even though if you look at the immunotherapy data from the KEYNOTE again, 6-7% of patients on that trial, in the post-metastasectomy, the hazard ratio is 0.4, suggesting there's a role to, with adjuvant immunotherapy, with Pembro, right? But that's actually the only piece of data that should suggest
But I do think you highlighted something important. At the time, the patients who were on the placebo arm, at the time of progression, you can't really... Right, but you can't really say all of them must receive the experimental arm because some of them, like you said, they may have like solitary area and the patient undergoes surgery. And at the time, you did not know that post-metastatectomy, you need to get Pembro. Some of them got radiation therapy and all of this. But do we don't have a breakdown for the ones that needed systemic therapy, how many of them received Pembro?
So of those who received subsequent therapy, 70% got checkpoints.
Okay, so that's the majority.
That's decent, yeah. A lot of patients, more than two-thirds, got, for those who receive subsequent therapy, right? Now, you could make the point, which I think some would make that point, that, well, in some areas of the world, you don't have access to subsequent therapies. The problem with that, as you know, Chetty, because you ran trials yourself, is when you run studies around the world and the patients come off study, it's very difficult to capture that information after patient comes off study. So I recognize that as a limitation is running any trial, not this particular trial, so I don't want to sound like I'm defending it, but it's difficult because we're talking about areas of the world where patients just get lost, right? Or, and so yes, we should ask as much as possible for the breakdown. I think that's truly relevant, but it is very likely that we'll encounter a situation where we don't have the data that we'd like to see.
Look, there is never a perfect study. I mean, let's face it, right? I mean, and I've said that, and I'll go to my grave saying this. There is no perfect study. And if you ever submit a paper without highlighting the shortcomings of your paper, the reviewers will reject it.
Right.
So you must always acknowledge this. But I mean, these, you know, there are some shortcomings with this. But was this practice changing to you? I mean, when you get a patient into your practice with kidney cancer after resection, is there a reason not to give Pembro at this point if you have access?
Well, I have a conversation with patients. Some patients, right. So what I do always, Shadi, I always do it for clear cell. It's exactly, you know, although in some of the studies, non-clear cell enrolled, but just to make the point, we're not doing it for non-clear cell. It's not price changing because I was already having those discussions with the patient.
Got it.
I'm using a risk calculator, you know, and there's a number of them. They're imperfect. There are a number of them online, but you'll be surprised because not everybody wants to get immunotherapy adjuvantly for a year, not being one of the five patients with significant side effects when their risk of recurrence is like 12 or 13%, right? So when you run the score, you see the number. People are not numbers, but people take that risk, that number in a different perspective, you know, and actually, so I think having those conversations about, listen, here's the data, and I always do that for a patient who would be eligible for Pembro, I have that conversation, right? And, you know, and part of my conversation is based on the risk that I, you know, that patient is at. So we run the risk for that particular patient, and we use that to make a conversation around pros and cons. And there are cons with immunotherapy. I believe after you've seen the survival data, I think the scale tilts a little bit more towards adjuvant immunotherapy, yeah. Right? Because it's hard to, you cannot pretend you don't know that, right?
And you know, look, I mean, the world of kidney cancer has never had any evidence that adjuvant therapy was improving survival. And let's face it, the sunitinib data was very poor. I mean,
that's like, correct. Yeah. I mean, at the time, you know, remember, no OS benefit with ESTRAC, which is a trial you're referring to with sunitinib. You do, if I remember correctly, 7 point something versus 5 point something. So it's a two year difference in DFS.
Yeah.
Remember, one of them you should supposedly be on sunitinib, right? And the discontinuation rates were actually quite high. So it's not a walk in the park. Actually, it's interesting to see that patients without cancer, right, on a target therapy, they might not tolerate the treatment the same way that a patient with cancer on target therapy, which is something interesting.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it was, despite being approved by the regulatory agency in this country, but for the most part, most folks were not offering adjuvant sunitinib to patients at the high risk of recurrence, you know, because number one, half of them were cured, and because of the safety piece of the story and without OS benefit.
Let's move to bladder cancer. I mean, the world of bladder cancer has changed a lot. And, you know, since ESMO 2023 with, you know, the first time anybody was able to beat immunotherapy, I covered that actually with your colleague Petros Grivas after ESMO. Was really fascinating. What did you learn? Anything new at ASCO GU?
Well, you know, we saw the data, you know, we're talking about the adjuvant data, right? And we saw the data from Andrea Apollo, you know, the adjuvant Pembro, Ambassador, big effort, cooperative group study, you know, and I think the results are not that different from the adjuvant Nevo. So I do expect that it's going to be available. We can make the critique that we have never seen a survival advantage with adjuvant immunotherapy in the bladder cancer world. I think perhaps one of the differences is I think the bladder cancer world is a little bit ahead of the kidney cancer world in regards to selecting the patients at the high risk.
But what's the Ambassador trial? Tell us the Ambassador
trial. Oh, sure. It's a, you know, basically a large trial showing that, you know, adjuvant pembrolizumab improves disease-free survival compared to, you know, observation, right?
Okay.
So, you know, and it was a large trial, many, many patients enrolled in that trial. And, you know, many years into, you know, Andrea was telling the story that she feels like that's her third, I think she's a
baby.
Mother too, third baby, because he has like 8 years in the making of this trial and making it happen. You know what I mean? So you know, it's 8 years later for you to present such relevant data. You know, it's definitely an important landmark. So anyway, so that's the trial. And I think that was the highlighting bladder, you know. I think the world, I see the world as pre and post ESMO, as you said it. We were all expecting to see the phase three trial with the infrutumab Pembro data. It was already approved, accelerated approval for cisplatin ineligible. But for the very first time, Chadi, I no longer think about cisplatin eligible and ineligible in the metastatic space, because my thought is, who is the patient who is not going to get evipepra, right? I mean, no matter how you spin that data, it looks good. So the challenge is going to be, can we develop projects and research to understand who are the patients not going to benefit from it? That, to me, is a challenge, because when we have such a positive trial, you know, it's almost like, okay, we'll do it to all. But we know not everybody benefits. I think the progressive disease at best response is in single digits, but around 8 or 9%. So there are still 1 out of 10 patients or so who won't benefit at all. It was not going to help them.
Yeah.
And I think knowing who they are is probably where we should focus our attention as well.
I mean, the one comment I have, is there anything else with bladder that is worth mentioning before I move to prostate?
I always think it's relevant to highlight the importance of genetic testing in bladder cancer and FGFR. We now understand not FGFR alterations matter. We're starting to focus more on the twos, particularly on the FGFR3s. So just a call for genetic testing is relevant in bladder cancer. Right. Erdafitinib has shown a survival advantage, and erdafitinib is a target therapy approved in bladder cancer, and it's being underutilized because we don't test for patients. So I forgive me, I never want to miss one opportunity to highlight the importance of genetic testing, in this case for bladder cancer patients.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you. Before we move to prostate, philosophically, I think the idea of adjuvant therapy, conceptually, you are going to overtreat a lot of people. It's just, in adjuvant therapy,
right,
we know we are overtreating some people, but we hope that by doing this, we are curing some people. And I think the field of adjuvant therapy would stand a lot to benefit if we're able to treat fewer people and help more people, narrow that gap. But it's impossible to answer the question that I don't want to treat anyone that does not need treatment today. 5 years from now, do you think we are making headways in the adjuvant therapy to be able to tell who we should withhold treatment from?
Yeah. So philosophically, that's a very important question. And by the way, it's not a original question. That question has been going on for a long time, right? And actually led to the FDA to actually publish on DFS, disease-free survival, as an endpoint for approval of drugs, right?
But the way I phrased it was very original.
Fantastic. No, this was for sure the first time I've heard it that way, which is amazing. But think about it, even in lung cancer, right? I'm not a lung cancer expert, so I can say whatever numbers I want, because probably I'm going to be wrong. But think about the adjuvant chemo for lung cancer, right? If I remember correctly, at least that's what I memorized for the boards, I think the benefit of chemo is not huge. The absolute benefit is around 4 or 5%,
very small.
If I remember correct. Yeah. However, it's very common, and you, by doing so, you're improving survival, you're helping people, and that's with the expense of overtreating a lot of patients, right? And we know that. So this is not unique of the kidney or bladder or GU world, to be fair. That's one part of the story, even with chemo. Now, I think people might accept that idea better because of my second point. And my second point is the mechanism of action. So my philosophical issue with target therapy in the adjuvant space, the way they work, they strive the tumor to death, right? They block the vessels. If you want to think angiogenics, they block the vessels, and it's unlikely for me to think that would lead to cures, okay? Because, but with chemo, I would accept that concept better, just because, you kill the cells that replicate faster, right? Not in a smart way. So
right.
If you have any cancer cell out there, it's going to replicate and it's going to die with chemo. So I think philosophically, the MOA of chemo, it makes us accept that a little bit better than, for example, angiogenic therapy. And I don't think it's a coincidence. And actually, to my knowledge, no angiogenic therapy has shown a survival advantage in the adjuvant setting ever. I might be wrong, but I don't think I am, because I had to do that work for the discussion on the kidney cancer. So I went through the cross solid tumors. And then we have this immunotherapy. We're still trying to figure it out, whether or not it's possible to cure some. And the reason why some of us will say, well, it might be, is because we're actually not acting against the tumor, right? You're actually making your soldiers in your body, your T cells, to get stronger, to then see the cancer cell as an enemy and attack them. So I also think that for the checkpoint inhibitors, I think we accept the concept that it might cure people better, more than we do for target therapies, for example. So that is, I think, philosophically one way to answer your question about what are we really expecting to see from an adjuvant approach. And I'll finalize by doing this, Shadi. It's always easy that we say it in Portuguese. There's a coach there, and he made a statement when he was getting an interview that everybody laughed, and that became a thing, a saying even today in Portugal. And it's something goes like this: prognostics are fantastic after the game in Portuguese. And it was
I like
like, I
it.
was like, you know, and it was so, but actually in oncology, if we knew what's going to happen to our patient, a lot of us would have made probably better, smarter
Of
decisions.
course.
We never know when is our last opportunity or the window opportunity to treat our patient the best way possible. If we do, we would pick the best weapons at that point, right?
In America, we call it, it's easy being the Monday morning quarterback.
Exactly, right? Yeah, correct. Because, you know, because, you know, you're very busy during the weekend with the sports all over. But so the point being, you know, we always think that in the United States, it's a matter of timing, now versus later, because I think we have, fortunately, many patients have access to all these systemic therapies at any point in time,
Right.
because the system allows us to do that. And I don't want to generalize because I know that's not true throughout.
Sure,
I just want to
sure.
say more patients had access to that. However, we never know how the patient will recur, what's going to happen to them. And a lot of times we do it, look at the real-world data, right? You know, we actually know that we lose more patients than we think we lose, and not as many patients are being treated for each line of treatment as we think initially they will be treated. So with that in mind, when we see data that shows a survival advantage, and when you ask patients and they tell you, number one is, I don't want to die from cancer, I want to be cured. And if you see data that suggests that long remissions or cure are potentially a thing, it's very likely that treating physicians will take that into consideration when they're thinking about adjuvant therapy.
Agreed. Let's move on to prostate. It got a little bit complicated. I want to divide prostate into two categories. One is the hormone-sensitive disease, and one is the castrate-resistant disease. So for castrate-sensitive disease, these are patients that historically we treated with androgen deprivation therapy, with the shots or surgical castration, and then over the past several years, we started adding stuff to the ADT, just giving context to listeners and viewers. And for the most part, it appeared that whatever you add is better than if you don't add anything.
Right.
What have we learned about castrate-sensitive disease after ASCO 2024, if any?
Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of updates from data. So that was the first part of the story, Shadi. We learned that chemo added to hormones was better. Then we learned that different NHTs was better to ADT. And more recently, we learned that, you know, triplet was better than a doublet with chemo. So we learned that. And I think where we are right now, we are exploring two or three different things in this setting. One is, can we optimize the selection of patients for doublet or triplet? So how can we do that, for example, or can we predict outcomes? So one way to do that is looking at things like PSA response after X number of months on treatment. It appears that that predicts outcomes, patients who do better, patients who do worse. Remember, we're still selecting patients
But
by
I never
volume.
know what's the advantage of that. Like, who you're still gonna continue? I mean, it's like, you
Right.
know,
Well,
are you unlikely to shift because the PSA did not nadir or something? Like, I don't know. I feel
yeah.
like it's a nice exercise. I'm not sure it add much.
Yeah, let me so it's a fantastic point. Let me give you one or two reasons why that could be relevant, right?
Okay.
So as a trialist, have a way to predict that if you would, let's say, median time to progression on a combo is going to be 3 years. Let's just accept that as a way to, you know, to think about this. Okay, if you have an easy way with a PSA to find out who are the patients, that the 20% of patients who are going to progress within a year, what you can do with that information is the next set of trial you're going to design a trial for those patients. How, for
I see.
example, you might intensify treatments for those, right? Where you say, you know what, if I know this patient by 6 months is not going to be without progression for 3 years, going to progress within a year, you might bring another treatment on board and see if that changed the outcomes. Another way is the opposite. If you are able to identify, Shadi, a patient that you know is going to be on that cocktail for 10 years, hypothetically, right? Then you can start thinking about, well, Pedro, maybe we should design a trial to de-intensify those patients. So okay. I think there's a lot of value in that, right? The other part of the story, as you predict the outcomes, as you know what's going to happen, there's probably those, you can identify patients who might not actually benefit from the androgen signaling pathway, which we're doing today. And maybe there are patients where you need chemo, different chemos, more aggressive chemo regs, or different MOAs, PARPs, radioligand therapy, mm-hmm. etc. And you can use the molecular profiling data to do that. For example, if you find a patient to be HR positive up front, right? Probably that patient should not be treated the same way as a patient who has an SPOP. And just to give context, SPOP predicts response to androgen signaling pathway, and HR is DNA repair defect. They tend to have poor prognostic, So just intuitively, even without showing you data, you would accept the idea, Shadi, that you would accept the idea that these patients probably need different treatments, right?
Yeah.
So you identifying early endpoints to allow you to predict who are surrogates for the long-term outcomes, I would argue that's beneficial to you and me, but also it allows you to adapt the conversations with the patient about expectations as well.
And I also like the idea that if you have evidence that the patients who don't really nadir their PSA within X number of months, these would be fertile grounds for clinical trials in these quote-unquote rad progressors.
Exactly.
So let's move on to castrate-resistant disease, which is obviously the fatal form of prostate cancer.
Right.
Folks who listen to this show are familiar with docetaxel, with the cabazitaxel, with novel hormonal therapies, all of this. What's new in that world? And I look right now with, unfortunately, King Charles of England being diagnosed with prostate cancer.
They came back and said it's not prostate cancer. It's some other cancer, but they don't say what it is. Maybe it is. I don't know. But they came back and said something
they
about.
They said he had a procedure
it's not
for
prostate.
Okay. Well, I think it's prostate, but
you might be right, right? But to your point, Shadi, what do we have available? So the one simple way to summarize what we call life prolonging therapies in mCRPC, right? We have a number of them. We have chemo, docetaxel, cabazitaxel. We have immunotherapy, still the old CLT, developed by Dr. Kantoff. You have a bone target agent still, radium-223, still around, not being used as much as before, but still around. You also have, obviously, novel hormonal therapies. Now, I know we're moving them early, but Abi and Enza were approved with survival advantage pre and post chemo, so there are life-prolonging therapies in that space as well. You have target therapies, PARP inhibitors, olaparib. Rucaparib is not available, but you have olaparib, also survival advantage. You have lutetium PSMA, so radioligand therapies, right? And you do have, for a fraction of patients, that we haven't seen survival because it's hard to conduct studies in the MSI population, but you could do immunotherapy for MSI, which is about 2-3% of people, or mismatch repair, which is about 2-3% of patients with advanced prostate cancer. So
you'd give pembro for these patients?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Actually, we publish the second largest cohort on MSI in the world, actually, in prostate cancer. One was in tissue from the Sloan group, from Dr. Abida. We published in liquid biopsy, believe it or not, MSI by liquid biopsy, patients treated with pembro. Very small number, 9 patients. And we just came out a recent paper this week on JAMA Oncology on tumor mutational burden on prostate by Dr. Dorf and colleagues.
Okay.
So the point being, you have these many therapies. So your question is, what novel therapy should we expect? And I think we should expect different things. There's the area of radioligand therapy is exploding, as you know. So lutetium PSMA is, first of all, is a target therapy, is a target radiation therapy, if you will, is a beta particle, right? So it releases radiation, those small particles. Mm-hmm. So you have other beta particles, and you have alpha particles, etc. So you also have bispecific therapies, when you have like this, you know, this molecule who finds, for example, CD3s, he finds the PSMA and gets them to talk to each other, right? The immune system to talk to the prostate cancer cells. That's another one. Then you can, you know, then I mentioned the PARP story. Then you have, for example, PROTAC machinery.
And these are all in trials, right? These are not
it's all trials.
These are in trials.
It's being tested in patients as we speak.
Right.
Absolutely.
But today, in the clinic, nothing has changed. You're just reviewing with us some of the new things that may be coming down the pike.
So the most recent ones in the last 2-3 years, lutetium PSMA became available. PARP inhibitors got approved combined with novel monotherapies. That's also new in the last 2 years, right? High dose testosterone is not approved because we haven't seen phase 3 data, but some groups do use high dose testosterone based on phase 2 data. And I do think, and obviously you can think about, you know, biomarker based approaches, you know, who basically based on NGS. I mentioned the main groups, either PARP inhibitors, immunotherapy. The third is based on chemo. It's called aggressive variant disease, which is basically TP53, RB1, P10, two out of those three. There's data that, you know, doing platinum-based chemo, carbocabazi, is superior to cabazitaxel, you know, and that's data from Anderson. And that's perhaps the three areas where I believe most folks are using molecular profiling to treat them, you know, in that approach. But basically, that's what we have today for men with prostate cancer.
That's excellent. I know. I mean, it seems like we've covered really what's relevant in prostate, in kidney, and in bladder. Is there anything else I may have missed?
Well, I mean, there's certainly certain topics that are emerging, Shadi.
Yeah.
You know, one topic is minimal residual disease, but mainly I should get you to talk about it, not me, because you are an expert. And you have, you know, you're developing your own assay for that.
Minimal residual disease is, you know, I mean, it's a very active topic. I think that the thing what I want to ask you about MRD is the prognostic value of MRD, I believe, is well established, right?
Yes.
We know that if you're MRD positive, you will have faster time to progression.
Yes.
The argument is, I don't know how long that takes.
Mm-hmm.
Do I need to do immediate therapy? Like if I'm MRD positive, and if you tell me I'm going to progress within 3 months, I probably would say probably I should get treated. But if you tell me, well, I don't know how long it's going to take, then I may say, well, I'll wait. It may take 2 years. And who knows, you may discover something you treat me with much better in 2 years than currently. See right. Where the struggle is with the MRD issue?
I completely see it. And I don't disagree. I think that's a fantastic point, right? You know, so it's complicated. I always like to think of the ovarian example. Again, I'm not an ovarian cancer doc. And I learned this not for my boards this time, or maybe for the boards 10 years ago.
Hey, I'm working on eliminating the board. It's not working so far.
I saw your, by the way, great podcast.
I'm working on the ABIM maintenance certification.
Maybe one way to, I shouldn't say what I'm going to say next, but apparently it was a fantastic discussion, by the way, between the CMO but apparently he's going to be a new person, right? That's what I heard.
Yeah, but nothing really is happening. Anyway.
You did your part, Shadi. But what I want to say is I want to use ovarian as an example, because I don't know if you remember that trial many years ago that used CA125, right, which is a biomarker, can be used as a biomarker. And the question was, when you see a rising CA125, should you start treatment right away or wait to see more disease in the scans, right? And it turns out that actually, you know, waiting to see more disease in the scans was not detrimental to patients. So in other words, starting treatment or chemo, you know, sooner was not helpful. Another way to see that is in prostate cancer, a lot of folks, you know, see PSA rising and start new treatment for them. That's actually an error, because this is a marathon. This is not a sprint. So if you treat the number, you keep treating the number, you run out of options. And when the patient really has disease that needs to be addressed, you run out of options because you kept treating PSA in case of prostate cancer. So I could not be more sensitive to the idea that it's not enough to show a marker suggesting that there's a higher chance of you having cancer. You have to really take the next step, which is, okay, we have to show that doing something about it, it's better than what we have currently.
Exactly.
And that step is crucial. It requires a lot of effort and energy and resources to
So
run the next level of studies for
where
that.
are in the GU world, where are you seeing folks studying MRD mainly in bladder, kidney, prostate, on everything?
So I think when you are more likely to test MRD in areas where you don't have good, easy, cheap, non-invasive biomarkers in the blood. So I don't think it's a coincidence that you don't see as much in prostate as you see in the kidney, because in prostate you have PSA. It's ultra sensitive PSA. It's very hard to beat that. It's actually very sensitive in the non-metastatic space. I think in blood and kidney, you not having a biomarker, I think you can explore that more. Now, as you know, I mean, you know this very well, kidney doesn't shred that much compared to bladder, so it's harder to do it in kidney than in bladder. So I do think of the three, I do believe bladder cancer is ahead, because I think we're closer to be using ctDNA as in routine practice to make decisions. And by the way, Shadi, people are already doing that. You know, there are already commercially available assays to do that, and they're making the decision about adjuvant immunotherapy for the positive ctDNA as they did on trial. And by the way, that phase three trial is ongoing. Tom Pauls is the PI on that trial in bladder cancer. So we are at different levels, but I do believe MRD will be more explored.
What's the trial of Tom? Do you know, like,
I can get you the name.
okay, yeah, I'm just trying, I'm
The
curious to
atezo
see.
is an adjuvant atezo based on ctDNA positive. I'm embarrassed because I should
Yeah,
know
no,
the exact
I was just
number.
curious.
311 maybe in
So
bigger.
one concept is MRD. We talked about all of these things. Is there anything, like, are there any new therapies that we should be on the watch for? And then I'll let you go.
Yeah, I think so yes, we are getting an emergence of theranostics, whether it's PSMA or other targets. So, for example, I love to look at HK2 in prostate, human kallikrein 2. I think you can look at kallikrein 9 and radioligand therapies in kidney cancer as well, right? By the way, the study is called IMvigor 11. Yeah. So just you know, that's one part of the story, you know. So certainly those therapies, they're fancier antibody drug conjugates or fancier chemotherapy products that are being explored, you know, in some cases at late levels of development. We having better scanning being developed, and I believe one of them in kidney at least likely is going to be available to patients very soon, based on phase three data, you know, already exists. So better imaging, other novel therapeutics, and I also think the genetic testing, I think we're going to move away. We're going to continue to report all exomal transcriptome, as you know, IHC, but I do believe the next step, we're probably going to start incorporating signatures. And so I think those areas, we're going to see a boom in the next 5 years. And then we're going to reshape how we treat and manage these cancers, because we have to incorporate those. Even PSMA, right? Think about it. PSMA PET is available, but we haven't incorporated them in the metastatic setting. So we will, the next step of trials will incorporate these areas and these technologies in the way we treat people.
It's a good time to be a GU oncologist, I
It's a
guess.
fantastic time to be a GU oncologist, and exciting times, good problems for patients, bad problems for us, because that means study more, pay more attention, attend more meetings, be on top of things. It's very, very difficult. It's a lot going on.
Especially the meetings. I think there's a lot of oncology meetings. Let's just be honest here. I mean,
That is very
you could
true.
literally be every weekend in a meeting if you
Oh, you
want.
can, yes. If you don't want to see patients, you just attend meetings, you know.
You just be in meetings all
Right.
year long.
One after the other.
Oh, Pedro, it's such a pleasure to have you on Healthcare Unfiltered. And make sure you send me your address so we can actually send you the best t-shirt in business. Really appreciate your time. Thanks for everything you're doing. And thanks for spending some time highlighting some of the updates of ASCO GU. And I really appreciate it, my friend.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to join the famous Healthcare Unfiltered
Oh,
and
you're the
to talk
best.
about GU. And always fun, Chatty, and congratulations, a fantastic project. Thanks
Next
for
time
having
when I
me.
bring you in, it's going to be a huge debate. We're going to have a heated debate where I'm going to make sure you disagree with somebody and the other person agrees. Like, it's going to be like a whole thing, because if we get fights on the show, we get more clicks.
So that is true. I have to say the GU community is so nice that you might have to pick a non-GU topic, because otherwise, you know, people in general are so nice and so polite and appropriate that, you know, I'm not sure we can get a
It's
fight.
like completely goes against being a GU oncologist, but I'll let it slide. Pedro Barata on Healthcare Unfiltered, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Shadi.
Folks, thank you so much for listening to Healthcare Unfiltered. I appreciate your support and being on this podcast. Thank you to Dr. Pedro Barata for giving us an overview of the clinically relevant data at the ASCO GU meeting 2024 that took place on January 25 to 27 in the city of San Francisco in California. Please subscribe to the show, like the show, write a brief review, and share it with others. You can watch all of the podcast episodes on my YouTube channel, Shadi Nabhan on Healthcare Unfiltered. And of course, if you want to read, how could you not read Toxic Exposure, the true story behind the Monsanto trials and the search for justice. Before I let you go, I'm going to leave you with a saying by Rumi. Let the beauty of what you love be what you do. Until next time.